you ever feel angry?
Hello. This is the Great Marquis of the Evolution and Control Committee. You are listening to the CITR 101.9 in Vancouver.
So what do we do? I want rage. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie. I want rage. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie.
Hey, this is Seeger from Toxic Narcotic, and you should drink some more on 101.9 FM CITR.
Can you tell me how to get to Sesame Street?
The radio show you are listening to is brought to you by the letters CITRFM and the numbers 1019. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the show.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
January 17th, midnight to midnight. Join CITR for Art's 1,042nd birthday.
70,000 die. One to eternal life. The other to eternal death.
I always blame myself for whatever's happened in my life.
That's Art's birthday, January 17th. 24 hours of radio art on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver.
When you're out with people, do you know what to do?
What to wear, your manners, and your attitude too.
Now here's a friendly cue for you in good taste.
Exquisite Corpse Radio, sound collage, radio art, plunderphonics, outsider music, field recordings. Putting the mental in experimental. The sound of modern art, Exquisite Corpse with Bleak. Reinventing radio every Wednesday morning, 10 to 11:30 on 101.9 CITR Vancouver. That's today's good taste tip.
To hell with everyone.
That was a good taste tip for you. Now here's something else that's good taste too.
Thank you. bi kelena hami chogoni o bebana mere chogoni o bebana kamana goa mere jogo o bebana furukunye jigire ye benka no nyofo kamfuro nyofo furukunye jigire ye jigi amina fara Togotia Nadungo era mogomina Alani mogontanya ni togontanya Adiara nelabi Alani furuke nyumantigia Benka no nyonfo sheri sheri Kamfuro nyonfo kabari kada furu kunye jigi minye Aha no jigi amina mfara okafo I am what I am my own special creation So come take a look Give me the hook or the ovation. It's my world that I want to have a little pride in. My world, and it's not a place I have to hide in. Life's not worth a damn till you can say I am what I am.
Try to see NPR 101.9 FM. Hang on. I figured out the problem. Oh, CITR 101.9 FM. I don't know why, but for some reason the microphones were all twisted in the wrong place here. But they're fixed now. I'm Heather, and this is Queer FM. Welcome to the show. That was Gloria Gaynor with the theme song, I Am What I Am. And coming up on the program tonight, we are very pleased to have Guy Kettlehack, the author of Vastly More Than That. It's kind of part of a series of programs we're doing for the start of the new year, 2005, looking at different subjects related to the kinds of resolutions that we make in a new year. You know, we resolve to get in shape, get healthy, get into recovery, whatever it is. And that's what we're talking about tonight is recovery. Guy is the author of, as I said, Vastly More Than That, which is a book about LGBT people in recovery. And that's what we're going to talk about. So stick around for that. There's also plenty of queer news coming up and lots of great music, too.
Mother got us in suicide tonight. Oh my God. And my mother got us in genocide tonight. Oh my God. And my mother got us in suicide tonight. Oh my God. Oh my God. Slam, bam, I come on scene, but like gasoline, you can tell I'm in the tank, like money in the bank. I smell appealing, but I'm toxic, can send you reeling without an inkling. Keep you thinking, cause you gave cash to the feds, left your school district for dead, fucked you up in the head, but still they saying nothing's wrong, selling firewater by outlawing the bong, still believing the system is working, while half of my people are still out of working. Anonymous notes left in the pockets and coats of judges and jurors from Frisco to Jersey. Threats and protests, politicians, mob debts, trumped up charges and phony arrests, staged a lethal injection the night before the election. Cause he got donation from the prison guards union. Oh my God. And my mother got us living suicide singing. Oh my God. And my mother got us living genocide singing. Oh my God. And my mother got us living suicide singing. Oh my God. Oh my God. Listening to my stethoscope on a rope. Internal lullabies, human cries. Thumps in silence, the language of violence. Algorithmic, cataclysmic, seismic, biorhythmic. You can make a life longer, but you can't save it. You can make a clone and then you try to enslave it. Stealing DNA samples from the unborn and then you coming after us cause we sampled a James Brown horn. Scientists who's got this progress. A four-headed sheep is their latest project. The CIA running like they're Jones from Indiana, but they still won't talk about that Jones in Guyana. This ain't no cartoon, no one slips on bananas. You really think that that car killed Diana? Hell, I shot Ronald Reagan, I shot JFK, I slept with Marilyn, she sung me happy birthday. Oh my God, and my mother got us living suicide singing. Oh my God, and my mother got us living genocide singing. Oh my God, and my mother got us living suicide singing. Oh my God. Politicians got lipstick on the collar. The whole media started to holler. But I don't give a fuck who they screwing in private. I wanna know who they screwing in public. Robbing, cheating, stealing, white collar criminal, McDonald eating. You deserve a beating. Send your home a weeping with the fat bill for your Caribbean weekend. But just about anything they can bust us. False advertising saying horrors of justice. You telling the youth don't be so violent. Then you drop bombs on every single continent. Man, mandatory minimum sentence. Once he got caught with a pocket full of medicine. Do that again, another 10 up in the pen. I feel so mad, I wanna bomb an institution. Singing, oh my God. Me and my mother got a sleeping suicide team. Oh my God. Me and my mother got a sleeping suicide team. Oh my God. Me and my mother got a sleeping suicide team. Oh my. Say na 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 na. And we say na 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 na. See, we keep moving on, moving on, 'cause they're never gonna stop us, no, 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 stop. Stop us now, now. Oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my. Sweet, 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 sweet.
Michael Franti and Spearhead on CITR 101.9 FM. Oh my God. And this is Queer FM for the queer community and all of our friends. Hello, I am Heather. And coming up on the show tonight, we are talking to Guy Kettlehack, the author of Vastly More Than That, all about queers. Well, the book is all about queers in recovery, and we're talking about recovery issues because it's the beginning of 2005, time of year when we all start to think about different changes that we want to make in our lives. And that, for some LGBT people, is one of them. So as I said, Guy is coming up to talk about that. And right now on the show, there is lots of queer news, and a bill to legalize gay marriage from coast to coast will become before Parliament in early February and should be law by the summer, says Justice Minister Erwin Cotler. Cotler told the Canadian Press that he'd like to think it will pass before the House rises in June, but even if he's wrong and the bill can't muster support from a majority of MPs, it won't stop the inevitable march toward gay marriage, he said. He noted that courts in 7 provinces and 1 territory have already struck down the traditional definition of marriage as an institution restricted to opposite-sex couples. Judges in other jurisdictions would eventually follow suit, with or without the blessing of elected politicians. The only way to thwart the legal evolution, said Cotler, would be to invoke the notwithstanding clause of the Constitution to override the Charter of Rights. Prime Minister Paul Martin has already said that's something he won't do. Sherbrooke University Hospital in eastern Quebec is accused of refusing to give fertility treatments to lesbians. The CBC reports that 2 lesbian couples have been turned away by the hospital's fertility clinic because of their sexuality. One of the couples has filed a complaint with the province's Human Rights Commission. She told the CBC that she was told on the phone the clinic would not do the procedure for a lesbian. Another lesbian couple came forward with a similar story. The women said they were denied by the CHUS 2 years ago and went to a private clinic. But the hospital denies the allegations. Spokesperson Annie Perrault told the network that the fertility clinic has never discriminated against lesbian women wanting in vitro fertilization. Perrault says the fertility clinic has been performing in vitro fertilizations on lesbians for years. And the New York Civil Liberties Union Friday filed a lawsuit in the state Supreme Court on behalf of a Rochester woman seeking health care benefits for her female partner who she married in Canada. The NYCLU filed its lawsuit on behalf of Patricia Martinez against her employer, Monroe Community College, as well as Monroe County. Martinez has been a word processing supervisor for the community college in Rochester since 1994. She has been in a committed relationship with her partner, Lisa Ann Golden, since 2000. Martinez and Golden solemnized their relationship in a civil union in Burlington, Vermont in July 2001 and were legally married in Niagara Falls, Ontario in July 2004. The women own a home together, share financial responsibility for their expenses and each other's needs, and have drawn up mutual wills. Barbara DeLu of the Genesee Valley chapter of the NYCLU says that last year Attorney General Spitzer reiterated that New York State recognizes out-of-state and Canadian marriages, even if the same marriages cannot be performed in New York State. The Martinez case is discrimination, pure and simple.
Deadly romance of a quick sideways glance. What am I supposed to do? Biggest eyes so blue. I said I would be true. I thought I would be true. I'm falling into some abyss. Tomorrow it may end. My body I will send back, but never free. Leave me, leave me, love me. Моя голова, серце моє, Боже мой, Боже мой. Моя голова, серце моє, що я будем робить, ой. Моя голова, серце моє, Боже мой, Боже мой. Моя голова, серце моє, що я будем робить, ой, ой. Lovers come and lovers throw their hearts out to the walls. Selves dissolve and fall. Oh, yeah. Moja hlava, serce moje, Boże moj, Boże moj. Moja hlava, serce moje, co ja budem robić, joj. Moja hlava, serce moje, Boże moj, Boże moj. Moja hlava, serce moje, co ja budem robić, joj, joj.
Arlington from the Wayland Jennies on CITR 101.9 FM. And if you were down at the Anza Club on Friday night, you saw the Jennies featuring Annabelle Schwostik, the new singer who replaced Kara Leff. And that was actually Annabelle who we heard before the Jennies with... Oh, how do you pronounce that again? Hang on. Ooh, I think it's Moya Slava or something like that. And yes, it was a fabulous, fabulous show. I hope you had a chance to see it. This is Queer FM. I'm Heather, and if you want to give us a call, the number is 604-822-2487. And, you know, it's January 2005, and the new year is when we often sit down and look at our lives and where we've gotten to and what we might like to change. And improve for the future. And that's kind of what we're talking about on the current issues of Queer FM, or the different kinds of things that we decide to resolve to in the new year, and what we can do in practical terms to help ourselves along. And tonight we wanted to talk about recovery, and we're really lucky to have Guy Kettlehack with us, who is the author of, well, many books on recovery. But of note to us in particular is one called Vastly More Than That, which is stories of LGBT people in recovery. Hi, Guy.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for
joining us.
Yeah, it's nice to be in Vancouver in this vicarious way.
What's the weather like in New York?
Freezing.
Is it?
Yeah, it was weird. It was kind of like a weird May day a couple of days ago, and now it's like around 30 or 25 or something, so it's cold.
What's that in Celsius? I have no idea.
Oh, you know, I have to realize it's.
I know it's below freezing.
Well,
but
it's just a little bit below zero, I guess.
Okay.
Celsius, is that right? Like it's 32 degrees is Fahrenheit. You know, we'll have a radio program on the difference between Fahrenheit and Celsius here.
Sure.
But, it's cold.
Yeah. Well, it's actually cold here too. It's there's snow on the ground here in Vancouver, which is very rare.
Which is unusual, isn't it?
Yeah. So you're not missing as much as you think you are.
Okay.
So am I allowed to ask you your recovery story?
Well, sure. I've been in recovery for quite a while. I grew up in kind of a South Shore, Long Island town, Amityville, the Amityville Horror, if you can remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Was pretty much of a garden variety alcoholic as I went on. I began being able to drink everybody else under the table, which many incipient alcoholics think means that they're not alcoholic, but actually it's often very common. It was a way to escape myself. It was a way to escape fears of being gay. And when I finally, I went to college in Vermont at Middlebury, and then I went to New York when I was about 25, and I really just sort of spiraled very quickly down into kind of sex club stuff and bars and alcohol and drugs, and just kind of, you know, had a pretty common experience, unfortunately, for a lot of lesbians and gay men that I've since come to know. And I just really hit a kind of moment of such utter black despair that I, you know, I really didn't feel I could go on any longer. And the circumstances were, I got home at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I lived in this apartment building that was across from a park, and I came on to some teenage kid who turned on me with a knife and somehow just missed knifing me, basically, and I was drunk and moneyless, and I had this kind of revelation at that moment where he ran into the park. I was lucky I wasn't killed, that none of this would have happened if I hadn't been drunk. And I sort of climbed up to my apartment and passed out and woke up the next morning and kind of got the second half of the revelation, which was I really didn't want to drink anymore.
Hmm.
I really didn't want to drink anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that magic X factor moment is, you know, and I, as much as I've written about it and thought about it, not really able, you know, the only kind of thing I know how to do in books is what I think you do in recovery, which is you tell your story, you know, you tell people's stories. I don't have any self-help tips about it. I just know that when you hit anything like that despair, there's something to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Did you come from a family where drinking was
no,
was
actually, it's which is interesting. You know, I had kind of weird parents. They were artists, but not bohemian. But they weren't alcoholics themselves. There may have been some genetic thing. I think my grandfather, who drank a lot of martinis, may have been alcoholic, but. I really didn't have a whole family thing, which is pretty unusual, you know, compared to a lot of other people I've known. It's almost like, you know, why am I gay? It's like, you know, nature and nurture. It's obviously some kind of mix, but the only way that I can make sense of it is not so much is that I was addicted to intensity. I wanted intensity, and that's just a part of my temperament. I mean, I'm still addicted to intensity.
Hmm.
And it's funny, it's almost like atomic power. It can be put to good or ill use, you know?
Hmm. Interesting.
So it was that kind of tug to the extreme, to wanting, you know, to wanting 110% of everything. I think that was more how I characterize what the push was, you know? And you know, like most stuff in temperament, you sort of have to learn how to lasso it and make it do your bidding to the degree you can. You know?
Mm-hmm. So, what was your first few steps in quitting drinking?
Well, I had I was living with a lover then who had been so distressed by my drinking that he'd started going to Al-Anon, and I don't know if I mean, your listeners probably know what that is. It's a it's also a 12-step group, you know, designed to help people whose loved ones are drinking, or, you know, well, in the case of Al-Anon, drinking. And we went out to Fire Island a lot, and he had a lot of Al-Anon friends, and I found them incredibly exasperating because they just spouted all this, you know, this damn jargon, and I just like reached for the vodka bottle, you know, when they were there. So, but it really got pretty untenable, but because of his experience in that, I knew what 12-step programs were. And in fact, before I had that moment at 3 in the morning, you know, I had been to a couple of AA meetings, usually drunk, actually, kind of sitting in the back and just grumbling, you know. But I'd gotten to a point where when I was in bars, I'd just, like, start crying for no reason or... You know, I was really coming apart, my physical health. I mean, I'm, like... 5'10" and 160 now, but I bloated up to something like 200 pounds of kind of green flesh. You know, I mean, I was really in a bad way. So I, you know, the house of cards had already kind of come tumbling down. But I did know about meetings, and those were an important part of my recovery. Technically, I shouldn't be saying that because it is an anonymous program, and I'm certainly not speaking for 12-step programs. I'm just speaking about my own experience of them. But they, you know, but the thing that tipped the balance was my despair and my hunger to have a new life, and then I could be receptive to it. More than receptive. I mean, I was begging for something, anything to, you know, tell me what to do, and people were there. And I was, you know, I was lucky. I was in New York, so there were a lot of, you know, the whole panoply of meetings to choose from, you know, a lot of lesbian and gay ones as well, you know, and so I was, you know, I was pretty lucky. I mean, it's been a long, tough row to hoe since then for lots of reasons, but, you know, my synonym for sobriety is consciousness, and or is conscious, mm-hmm. It's a better deal being mm-hmm. conscious, I think.
I was just going to say, I mean, what's it been like for you, or what was it like for you giving up drinking after, you know, all that time of
well,
not
I've,
being conscious, I guess? I mean,
yeah.
you obviously started very young, so, I mean,
right.
are you essentially going through a process of almost, you know,
well,
starting from scratch, getting to know who you are as a human being?
I think so. I didn't really know who I was. I mean, you know, I've been through, you know, quite a few years since that moment. And, you know, the first book that I wrote was Easing the Ache, which was a book about gay men and in recovery. And the first version of that book was based on a diary I kept from the moment I stopped drinking. And I had worked in publishing. I was a literary agent. But, you know, my diary entries was, wow, oatmeal is really good. You know, it was like incredibly boring to anybody who had a life, you know. And yet I kept these, like, you know, these tiny little things. I'd spent all my time in bars after work, so I went home and I watched these reruns of sitcoms, and I mashed potatoes, and I had this kind of, like, you know, and went to a lot of meetings, but very kind of normal life for the first time in years. You know, I was actually, like, getting up at a normal time. I wasn't throwing up. I didn't feel, you know, like a, you know, a puddle of, you know what, you know, and I had an editor friend, in fact, and I sent him this cartload of diary entries, and he said, it's too early to write a book, guy. Just hang on for a year and a half or so. And he was right. I mean, but that's, I guess, by way of saying that I really was bewildered. I mean, I was shell-shocked, and yet for me, I was lucky. I loved it. I was so ready for it, you know. It was just like I could see colors in the world again, you know. I slept for the first time, you know, rather than passing out.
Mm-hmm.
Sex was a different ball of wax. That I had to relearn, like over time. And that's I think that's a tough one, especially for us, you know, to because it's so linked. And especially now to drugs like crystal meth, and which is like rampant in this country. I mean, I don't know what it's like in Vancouver, but it's, you know, huge in San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York. It's really endemic, and it's such a sexual drug for gay men,
mm-hmm.
That it's a whole new ball game of recovery, really. But I tried in vastly more than that, though, because, you know, because so many of my friends were women as well as men, and there was really no book that kind of tried to address both, you know, that, you know, and I, in fact, I had written one that was addressed to men directly, so it was kind of nice to be given the opportunity to do that, because there was so much commonality, and that I was seeing in my friends that, you know, that really wasn't being reported on,
mm-hmm.
so I was kind of glad to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. So what, I mean, you said that the experience for you is obviously really enjoyable and exhilarating.
Mostly, you know.
Yeah. You know, clearly it isn't that way for everybody. Can
no.
you talk
no.
about, well, I mean, in all of your years being part of, I guess if you could call it the recovery community.
Yeah.
And yeah. observing different people's processes.
Yeah.
What do people go through? What, you know, what is there such a thing as a typical process?
I don't think there's any such thing as a typical process. I do think there are certain rites of passage many people seem to go through. In fact, I also have a series out from Hazelden called First Year Sobriety, Second Year Sobriety, and Third Year Sobriety, which attempts to look at, you know, what it's like during that shell shock state and kind of how you sort of piece together a self, really, over time. you know, with the caveat that, you know, it's different for everybody, but there are some things that seem to be the same. You know, there I think it depends on temperament. You know, there are some people who are really dragged kicking and screaming into anything new, and then when they finally kind of adjust, they can't imagine how they live without it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There are others who relapse a lot, you know, and who may need to, you know. I had a kind of moment of epiphany where a light went on, but a lot of people don't, you know. I mean, a lot of people, it's kind of just a trickle. It's just an incremental, you know, things get better a little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I've known people who never spoke a word for the first couple of years in recovery, and then suddenly they began to talk. I've known others you can't shut up, like me. That's probably why I write. You know, I mean, it's so different. I think, you know, if I can make any observation about it generally, it's that we all bring who we are into this new realm of consciousness. We don't suddenly turn into different people, you know. We've got the histories that we have, and something, you know, it can range from terrible family experiences, horrible abuse, you know, long generations of addiction and alcoholism. I mean, I was not saddled with that. I had other stuff, but you know, we all come in with different baggage. There are ways of dealing with it, though, and I don't want to do a commercial for AA or CA or any of the other A's, but I wrote one book called Sober and Free that attempts to kind of look at different approaches, you know, that people have taken. The 12-step one is not the only one you can take, but it does seem to be a pretty good plan, at least in my experience, for dealing with whatever your temperament happens to be.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. So what are some of the rites of passage, would you say?
Well, I think the first thing is learning what to do with your time, you know, because the whole thing that has to change. In fact, the subtitle of First Year Sobriety is When All That Changes Is Everything. You really kind of need to restructure your time and the places that you were used to going to. You will sort of realize in recovery you can't. And most importantly and most dicily, the people that you're involved with, you have to kind of take a new look at. You know, it's why, so there's this whole rite of passage at first is, what do I do at 8 o'clock in the morning and 10 o'clock in the morning and 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and what do I do after work, or, you know, all that kind of stuff is like a rite of passage of just learning to organize your day in a different way. I think when you get into the second year, it's, you know, there is some truth, I think, to the terrible twos, that when you somehow, one of the most dangerous times, such statistics as there are, is in about the 11th month of sobriety, because you're kind of getting to the year mark, it's very common to kind of panic at that point, saying, like, what am I doing? Never for the rest of my life can I ever have another drug or drink? I mean, what am I, you know, there does seem to be this common moment of panicking. Not for everybody, but, and that's just something to realize. The other thing is that feelings, you're going to start to feel in ways that you haven't, you know, possibly for many years. And there's kind of a slogan that you'll hear in 12-step programs, that feelings are not facts. And that's a real, you know, the greatest task, I think, for anyone in recovery is to realize that you can have a feeling and not act on it.
You know,
you can actually have it, you know, and not bolt or act, you know. And there are ways of learning to do that. So that's kind of rite of passage. I've actually never been crazy about the slogan of feelings are not facts. I mean, they're not. They're important, though. You know, I've always thought of them as a kind of mental weather. You know, they kind of tell you who you are and how you are, you know. So they're important, but I guess it's like a thing that people go through, is learning how to how to contain them and how to tolerate them. You know, the other thing about recovery, and it's probably why I've written about it or why I've been interested in it, the interesting part is not the alcohol or drugs. The interesting part is that you catch people in the act of becoming human, of becoming more human. You know, that's what's interesting. You know, if it were all a matter of, I don't know, strategies about how to keep, you know, from doing drugs or alcohol, it would be very boring. But what's so exciting is that you see people, you know, fundamentally changing, you know, and there's nothing more interesting or exciting to me than that. You know, I think we're just more human than most people.
You think you're more human?
Well, yeah, more.
Why do you say that?
I just mean that, you know, there's a... I don't know any recovering addict or alcoholic or active addict and alcoholic who doesn't have a kind of what is essentially a really fierce spiritual hunger for something. You know, which is probably why a spiritual solution is so effective, because that's really what we're after. You know, and that you know, the quality of somehow creating a life that feeds that hunger is how you find out what a human being is all about. Maybe I'm getting out in the ozone with this, but there's something really exciting about watching people get conscious. You know, and it's different for all of us. And you know, there's a lot of stuff to deal with. You know, I mean, again, I think especially for my lesbian and gay friends, the whole sexual and relationship thing is a big, 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 big deal, you know. I mean, especially if, as is often the case, you're already with a partner who maybe still drinks or uses drugs, you know. And to navigate that is, you know, takes a lot of one moment at a time decisions and self-care, you know. So it's, you know.
What are some of the challenges that you've seen people go through, and how do they deal with them?
Well, I've had kind of an interesting window on stuff in New York before and after 9/11, for example, because when that all happened, a lot of people who were just newly in recovery, you know, didn't know if they'd be able to sustain the recovery, because it was just such a trauma that you wanted to escape, you know. So if you only had like a couple of weeks of sobriety or a couple of months of sobriety, you know, you wondered if you'd be able to make it through. And some did and some didn't. I think because, especially with gay men, there's been so much seroconversion, especially as a result of doing drugs like crystal meth, you know, health stuff is challenge. You know, is a part of a challenge that again. But I think what I've discovered, you know, as I've kind of observed those who are able to sustain their recovery in face of all that stuff, or family stuff, or like, you know, a lot of people who are in their 40s and 50s now, their own parents are dying. I mean, all of these kinds of, these moments in life are, you know, are certainly challenges. But I think the people I see who've been able to successfully meet whatever the challenge may be are the people who know that their life is made of more than the trappings. It's more than the relationship. It's more than the job. It's more than having the car they want. It's, you know, when people come into recovery because their lives got bad, I'm a little, you know, that they lost the job, they lost the relationship, and now they lost the money. I'm a little on the alert, because I think for it to take, you have to kind of have that spiritual hunger. And not sort of hitch your wagon onto whether you have the right home or not. You know what I mean? It's the people who kind of attend to this spiritual hunger who seem to manage to get through whatever the circumstances of their life may be. And I've seen a lot of people deal with horrendous loss and stuff, but who manage to kind of get through because they've cultivated a kind of a spiritual solution, really.
Mm-hmm. So you think spirituality of some kind doesn't
I'm not crazy about the word, but I just know it has to go deeper than wanting, you know, the right lover, car, home, or job. You know, that's the task here. The task here, you know, again, is to become more human. You know, is to feed your heart.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that sounds a little airy fairy, but it's like, you know, I've seen, why I mention is that I've seen a lot of people who, when they don't get, you know, what they call cash and prizes, they go out and drink and drug again. You know, it's like, that's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
The point is being human.
Hmm. Do you know, do a lot of people find that when they come off of whatever drug they're using or alcohol, that they discover that they have underlying mental health issues that they need to seek more adequate medication for?
Well, in fact, you know, you mean in terms of like psychotropic stuff or
mm-hmm.
or depression and things?
Yeah.
Sure, you know, but again, I don't know that it's, I mean, I certainly know it's kind of hard to sort out in the culture right now, which is sort of the cultural pressure to go on antidepressants and what may be the product of alcoholism. I mean, I know a lot of people who do get help from that, who really have been diagnosed with clinical depression. It is a slightly different challenge for people in recovery, because we tend to be pretty wary of anything we put in our bodies, you know. So we don't, you know, the people I've seen who've been most successful or who've been able to take those kinds of medications have really sat down with their doctors and told them, look, I'm in recovery, and what are the options? And just to kind of be alert as they go through it, you know.
Mm.
But I don't know if there have been any studies done. If there have, I haven't pursued finding them about whether there's a greater incidence of depression in recovering people. I mean, there may well be. I mean, it would make sense in a way. But I think there's also a greater alertness to medications and possible options, you know, for not doing them. But physical health is also a big deal, because a lot of people just completely ignore that. I know I did, and I've talked about the two terrible T's, teeth and taxes. You know, I mean, people just ignored both of those for years. You know, and you know, often going to a dentist is one of the, you know, the first esteemable acts that people end up doing. You know, I didn't believe I entirely physically existed. I mean, you know, I had to really start from scratch, you know. Mm-hmm. And luckily there are a lot of people, a lot of really good people in recovery who can be your friends and who can give you a lot of support. And I think that's the most wonderful note of hope, you know. There really are people out there who can help you.
Mm-hmm. Any other words of advice for folks that are thinking of getting into recovery?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I would never want to be a poster boy for it. All I can say is that if there's a kind of nagging despair, you know, a nagging darkness in your gut, and nothing else has kind of worked, you might want to see what it's like to go through a stretch of time not doing it, and see if you can. And if you can't, you know, I would suggest checking into a 12-step meeting and sitting and listening and seeing if anything takes. Or you could, and you know, you can pick up vastly more than that and see if you relate to any of the stories.
Mm-hmm. Which is available at Little Sisters here in Vancouver.
Oh, is it? Good. I'm glad. Mm-hmm. Good. Good. Yeah. Well, it is, you know, since a lot of people are kind of buying books online now. It's you know, a lot of people get it from Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Hazelden. So,
And of course, people can do that too.
Well, indeed, yeah. No, I would say certainly go to your local bookstore, you know, before all else, because they need your business. But I'm glad it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great. Well, Guy, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. And
well, thank you for having me.
And helping us out.
Okay. Well, good luck, and hopefully I'll get to go to Vancouver in the flesh one of these days.
That would be great.
Okay, you take care.
Have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.